rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. All about business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Smith against the Secretary. Will counsel enter your appearances, starting with the appellant?
Your Honor, my name is Jeffrey Martin, counsel for the estate of Mr. Smith and his daughter, Essex.
Thank you. Government?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Carson Guerin with James Cowden on behalf of the Secretary.
Thank you. All right. Proceed. Would you like to reserve some time?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
Thank you.
All right. May it please the Court. This case is one I've been involved with for a dozen years. It has a very long history. And I understand that we're not here to discuss the merits or the lengthy history of...
Well, don't be so sure. We may seriously have some question about the merits.
I want to thank the Court first for clarifying the issues that we need to address to deal with the standing question that's the subject of our hearing today. I represent Ms. Hicks in the issue of whether or not she and her estate can be substituted for her father, Thomas Smith, in connection with his claim for reimbursement of approximately $34,000 in costs to construct a therapeutic spa in his home under the Special Adaptive Housing Program. Apart from, although we'll focus on standing issues in this hearing, as I understand, there are two merits issues that we contend have never been fully addressed below and are appropriate for determination by this court if we can get past the standing question. The first one is our contention that the Veterans Administration incorrectly assumed that Mr. Smith had to prove a total inability to walk in order to prevail on his claim for a special adaptive housing grant. Secondly, that Mr. Smith had to apply for this grant before he could construct it in order to receive funds, even though at the time he spent the money, there was no such pre-authorization claim. Now, those are the merits issues we would hope to address in due course.
Let me interrupt you, if I may. Who made that decision on the merits, the one you just described? Who at the VA? What were the qualifications for the person or persons who made that determination?
It was first made by the board and by I believe, Judge Jagger in her 2015 opinion. And that was...
That's the first time it was made?
Yeah, I believe so.
Was it made below at the regional office or anywhere else?
No, the regional office decisions primarily focused on the disability requirement, whether or not he had shown adequate disability in order to receive that kind of...
And what was that conclusion? At least one government doctor said he should have it.
Yes, he constructed this spa because his doctor recommended it for him. And in fact, if you go through the record, you will see that the $34,000 in expenses were documented down to the penny. There are dozens of receipts. He assumed it was going to be paid for because he did it on basically VA doctor's advice. And it saved the VA considerable funds because he could be treated at home as opposed to going to the VA hospital for treatments.
Any dispute about either of those contentions?
No, I don't believe so.
All right. Mr. Martin, could I ask you a question? So there was a June 2008 rating decision.
Yes.
In this matter.
Yes.
In which the VA found the veteran ineligible, right?
That's correct. Although I think this is a bit of a red herring. It was featured in the Board of Veterans Appeals decisions and the Board's ruling on motion for reconsideration. But that decision related to a May 2007 request for compensation, and the service-related disability was determined to be if I can say this properly, epididymitis of his left scrotum with a 10% disability rating. That is not something that would have been sufficient for construction of the spa.
But that was not his
doctor's advice either. So the record at the time that particular decision was made really wasn't sufficient to support much of a disability claim at all.
So then on that ground, just so we're on the same page, because the world changed, the facts changed,
yes,
after the June 2008 decision, there's no preclusive effect then for the fact that that decision wasn't appealed?
No, there should not be any. What happened after that were a number of subsequent requests for reopening of the record. And if I can,
if you bear with me, I find the number of occasions.
The only thing I would suggest is that you can go to the council table, but speak, because we're recording this for YouTube. So,
forgive me. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, we have to be the YouTube stars, so let's not, you know, take that away from us.
I'll take notice. For the record, he made submissions to the VA on May 8th, 2007, February 23rd, 2010, March 7, 2013, May 22nd, 2013, and April 10, 2015. There were decisions as a result of those submissions by the VA on February 1st, rather than the 2008 decision that I just referenced. Then there was another one on February 1, 2011, January 12, 2012, March 10, 2012, and then the board decisions, then there was one on February 7, 2014, which stated that the claim was reopened and denied. I mean, that is in the statement of the case. And on March 11, 2015, which also stated that the case was reopened and denied.
What did they do?
Pardon?
What did they do besides say reopened and denied?
They found the disability insufficient to justify the...
Well, what did they do? Did they reexamine the facts?
They did. Each time there was new information, new evidence submitted. But the problem was that we were up against a stone wall. Effectively, we were led on a wild goose chase because they expected us to prove that Mr. Smith was unable to walk in order to qualify for the...
And you say that was the wrong standard.
That was the wrong standard. As decided subsequently in the Jensen case, that isn't the case.
But can I just, on that point,
yes.
Okay, so, but we're reviewing the July 29, 2015 board decision, right? That's the decision that's before us.
Yes.
Okay. So... Let's assume that the 2008 rating decision doesn't have any preclusive effect. Okay, so I'm with you on that for now. Okay, so you were led unfortunately and inadvertently, in my opinion, the court through the clerk's office issued a number of orders to you directing the parties to talk about certain things. And so what I'm going to say now is not pejorative, but the position has sort of shifted somewhat on the reason that substitution is appropriate here. And I think that you were simply responding to the leads the court gave you about what to talk about. But as I understand the position as we finally ended, your last submission, I think, was in October 2021, if I'm not mistaken. And
yes, October 7, 2021.
Right. And in that, you seem to now be at the position to say that you agree that the statutes and regulations do not address the specific issue of, quote, non-accrued benefits, right? They are focused on accrued benefits. Is that right?
That is correct. The statutes and regulations don't fit this particular situation for specially adaptive housing benefits.
So
we've made three arguments in that submission, which is, we think, alternative grounds for finding substitution in this case. The first is under the Rule 43 standard, as interpreted by Breedlove, Reege, and Demery, basically to show that the claim but this, the substitute claimant has a claim that's authorized by the regulations, and secondly, that there's injury in fact standing. The second argument we've made is that the non-pro-tunk test still could apply in this situation if the existing regulations under 5121 and 5121A of Title 38 don't fit this particular claim. And the third argument is that you still could find under a liberal interpretation of those regulations that standing would be appropriate. Those are the grounds for substitution that we're alleging at this point in time.
So I have a more basic question. If we start from the proposition that the statutes and regulations deal with accrued benefits and not non-accrued benefits, one-time payments.
Yes.
Why wouldn't the most obvious answer be that there isn't substitution allowed for those benefits under the law as Congress has enacted it?
Well, one answer is that there are regulations that deal with payment of SAH, Special Adaptive Housing Benefits, to an estate. 38 CFR, 36.4406, subsection C, states the following. Should an eligible individual die before the Secretary disperses the full Specially Adaptive Housing grant, the eligible individual estates must submit to the Secretary all requests for reimbursement within 1 year of the date of the loan guarantee service learns of the eligible individual's death. So we have language in that regulation which acknowledges that the estate is a proper party to receive the reimbursement. And in this case, if you read that regulation, the estate should have within 1 year to make the submission of what the expenses were. Well, those expenses were awfully documented in 2010, in the first time I was involved in this case.
So the government already knew about it.
Absolutely.
To the penny, as you will.
To the penny.
So what more does the government need in order not to be prejudiced? Or
From my perspective, there's no argument that they weren't fully on notice of the death. They weren't fully on notice of the amount of the claim. And more importantly, what I find most troubling about the posture of this case is the argument that the VA has made that we should have filed a separate claim now with the VA and go through the same process where we've already made, I think, five or six different submissions to the VA, and they've addressed those submissions in six different decisions, including the last two boards.
And you're here.
Yes.
So why shouldn't we consider that it's been made?
Absolutely. We think it's right for that ruling. There's no reason to send us back to a board.
But Mr. Merton, to be fair to the VA's position on this, it's you focused on the fact that there's a statute that allows for a substitution in the context of accrued benefits, right? And You've made a very interesting point that the beginning part of that talks about any benefit before it then goes on to use the word accrued.
Yes.
So you're basically saying, in response to the first question I asked you about the statute, I read your briefs to basically be saying, well, Congress did provide for it, maybe not as clearly as with accrued benefits, by using this language, right?
Yeah.
But it seems to me that what the VA is saying is, and I don't mean to put words into the VA's mouth, but is that, you know, you got to take the good with the bad. And if the good part of that statute is that it allows a non-accrued benefits claimant to use that process, then why wouldn't a non-accrued benefits plaintiff or claimant still need to submit the form that VA says needs to be submitted in the regulation within 1 year?
Well, constructively, that was done here because the same day that we filed the motion for substitution, we filed the form with the VA saying that Ms. Hicks was going to be substituted for the claim. They knew that.
Well, it's not a question of knowledge, though, is it? I mean, what's the purpose of that 1 year period? It's to, as I understand it, it's to let the agency make a determination about, in the first instance, about the appropriateness of a substitution.
Well, that might be the case if the agency hadn't already decided that issue several times before.
But well, how could the agency
exercise it? We had the choice.
No, how could the agency have made a determination about whether Ms. Hicks should substitute for the appellant here because the appellant was still alive. They might have made a decision on the merits of the claim about whether reimbursement is appropriate here. But isn't that distinct from whether the adult child can substitute into a case here at the court?
I don't think so. We think that's an issue that this court can decide under Rule 43 for substitution. We know that there's law authorizing payment to an estate. We know that there's injury in fact in several respects. Number one, although this is a small amount, Ms. Hicks did, without dispute, pay some funds for the funeral related expenses, and arguably that falls within the language of the regulation authorizing payment for last sickness and burial. We also know, and I think this is really significant, and that's what makes our case, I think, unique. We also know that Ms. Hicks has been paying essentially for the cost of that spa. Mr. Smith took out a second mortgage back in 2007 to cover those expenses. When he died, it wasn't fully paid off. So from his death in 2019 to today, I saw her just last Friday, she's been paying those expenses. She's been the one with an injury in fact, with a claim on her own, but on behalf of the state, to receive the funds back from the VA that we contend her father should have received when he was still alive. So that makes this case, I think, very unique. I'm not sure how, from a precedential standpoint, it is interesting from the question of how a one-time payment fits into the statutory benefit scheme. But from a pure question of legal standing and injury in fact, you have regulations, number one, which authorize payments to an estate, and number two, you have injury in fact in the form of payments by Ms. Hicks and in the form of her second mortgage payments, and you have the fact, this is another injury in fact, the third element, that if the claim is allowed, the estate will receive the funds, and they will be distributed in part to her because she's a beneficiary of the estate. That isn't something that the VA needs to decide. It should be obvious on this record, and there's the affidavit from Ms. Hicks is in that record, that this court can decide that standing question without asking the VA to go back and do what they've done before, we believe, which is deny a claim without adequate legal basis.
Judge Falvey, did you have a question? I'm sorry.
No. I was looking at
good. Good afternoon, Mr. Martin. So on your Rule 43 argument, it strikes me that that rule is a mere procedural rule that doesn't create any substantive rights. And you have to find those substantive rights somewhere else to the extent provided by law or whatever the rule reads. Where are you finding the right to substitution such that that rule, procedural rule, could be applied?
Well, first, as I explained, it's in the context of the regulation that authorizes reimbursement to the estate. She is the appointed representative of the state. The D.C. Probate Court has appointed her as the representative.
Could you give me the specific regulation site that you're relying on so that I'm just clear on?
38 CFR 36.4406 subsection C.
Okay.
That's the regulation that says in the estate, if in the case where the claimant has not been reimbursed in full, and that's our case because he hasn't been reimbursed a penny, then the estate is the one with the right. You then have the standing question about injury in fact, and I mentioned the three elements where we do have Ms. Smith documenting that injury. One, funeral expenses, so, two, the second mortgage, and three, the money she'd receive from the estate.
So you're not finding this right of substitution or entitlement to substitution in Rule 43 itself. I just want to...
I think that's correct. Okay. I would analyze the legal issue.
And one of your arguments to the regulation you cited, and the other is just there's the injury, the fact of injury, the standing.
Yes, you need...
But standing provides the substantive right.
Standing by itself doesn't provide the substantive right. It's the way the regulations are set out.
So back
to... Number one, to authorize in the first place these grants. And then the question is, who's entitled to receive those grants when a veteran dies? That's one. And the second is this regulation that specifically focuses on the estate's right to receive the money when the claimant has died.
But that regulation does require itself that something be submitted within 1 year.
Yeah, and my point is that the submission was made in 2010.
So, no, I understand your argument. Your argument is we didn't need to do it again because we did something before. But if we're going to read the statute, the regulation actually says that the secretary will not reimburse except in equity or good conscience, right, a standard devoted to the secretary's discretion, will not reimburse an eligible individual's estate for a request that has not been received by the department within this time frame, and that time frame is within 1 year of death.
And she was moved to be substituted within that time frame.
Here, at the court, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And we also put the VA on notice the same time that Ms. Hicks was going to be the substitute for the claimant.
What's wrong with our analysis of this is you made the request here. The VA is on notice, or the department, or the secretary is on the same kind of notice as if you had filed this form with them, and we did it within the 1 year, because you're already here on the case. Isn't that so?
That's exactly right. And it would have been.
So why are we, what is the government's case, from your standpoint, meaning the government's case made below before they got here, as to why they can't look at substance over form?
I ask the same question, Your Honor. I see no justification.
Let me ask you one other question. Under what statutory scheme was this regulation that you've mentioned adopted? The broad power of the secretary or a specific statute?
I believe it was under the authority of the Special Adaptive Housing Program statute, which
is a statutory scheme.
Yes.
And so your argument is consistent, I take it, with what you believe is congressional intent.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
But before you sit down,
we've given more time, so.
So, and I know Judge Fowley has a follow-up.
I have reserved some time for rebuttal, but yes.
No, this is not coming out of your rebuttal time. Just
fine.
Keep going.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Greenberg is generous. So you mentioned that the D.C. court has now appointed your client as the personal representative of the estate?
Yes.
I take your word for that, but there I didn't see anything in the record that the court had been notified of that. And so
We notified the court that was in process. It took a while for Ms. Hicks to work out arrangements with her siblings to make sure everybody was on board with the process. I do have a copy with me of the court's order.
Well, and you don't have to give it to me. I would suggest that it might be worthwhile submitting just a notice to the court, just because there was a fair amount in the briefing about.
I will submit that notice after the briefing.
And the only reason I'm doing that is it takes one argument that you made off the table, the argument that we have an independent authority to appoint a personal representative. If a competent court of jurisdiction has appointed the representative, that at least takes that off the table.
I understand, Your Honor. I will submit that. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm good. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We'll hear from the government.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Carson Garand, and with James Cowden, we represent the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The issue in this case, of course, is whether the adult child of the deceased veteran can substitute into the appeal in which the deceased veteran sought reimbursement for specially adapted housing benefits. It's the Secretary's position that the proposed substitute cannot substitute into this appeal for two primary reasons. First, although this Court may have authority to issue nunc pro tunc relief in this matter, the issuance of such relief is inappropriate because appellant has not, or the proposed substitute has not satisfied the three prerequisites required by this court. Additionally, the proposed substitute lacks standing. Accordingly, the secretary requests that this court deny the motion to substitute and dismiss the appeal. And, Your Honors, I'll first address the standing issue, which seems to be the primary issue here. The Secretary wouldn't make an absolute statement regarding whether substitution and would be appropriate in any claim for non-accrued benefits and you know, whether or not the proposed substitute would have standing. But certainly in this instance, substitution is not appropriate because the proposed substitute does not have standing.
Wait a minute. You're just going around in a circle. Why doesn't the proposed substitute have standing?
The proposed substitute does not have standing because there's no mechanism by which they would be entitled to this money. Your Honor,
what do you mean no mechanism?
Your Honor, in the accrued benefits statutory context, for example, Section 5121 allows for survivors to recover accrued benefits, which are periodic monetary payments. And typically, the Secretary would agree that when a potential accrued benefit claimant has filed a claim with the VA within 1 year, and VA has determined that claimant to be eligible, the Secretary would typically agree that proposed substitute has standing. They are affected by the board decision and the proceedings that occur thereafter. In this context, even if this court were to determine that substitution was appropriate, and they were to find that there was certain board error below, there's no mechanism, there's no statute by which the veteran can recover these benefits.
What if we say there is?
Your Honor.
Do we have the power to say that?
Your Honor.
How do you call it nunc pro tunc or our inherent equitable authority or statutory construction, our interpretation of the statutory scheme of Congress? Do you have any quarrel with our ability to do that? I'm not saying we will, but...
Your Honor, the only regulation that the proposed substitute here can point to is 38 U.S.C. 36.4406. If you look at the entirety of that statute, it really is predicated on a determination that the veteran was eligible to receive specially adapted housing benefits and that there was some conditional approval. And then Subsection C, again, as Judge Allen was noting, requires that a request for reimbursement be filed within 1 year and that, again, that the veteran be deemed eligible. And here, Your Honors, we have a July 2008 rating decision that has been final. The veteran did not attempt to file a motion to revise that based on clear and unmistakable error. He did not appeal that decision. As far as I know, there's nothing in the record to demonstrate that his low back disability, which was the disability in which he was seeking the specially adapted housing benefits, met the requirements of the specially adapted housing statutory scheme. So without a statute or something allow the claim to continue after the veteran's death and then allow for entitlement for the proposed substitute, there is no standing because even if this court were to determine that there was board error, there's no way in which the proposed substitute could recover the benefits here. Your Honor,
could you help me with the specially adapted housing benefits? I haven't had many cases involving them since I've been here, but... And I was going around and around about the 2008 board rating decision as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it strikes me, and I think the board acknowledges this in its decision here as well, that sort of specially adapted housing benefits are a little different than normal. In fact, I think what the board says is actually something like, you don't need to submit new and material evidence under the old system to reopen the claim. Precisely because just because I've been found ineligible because I have an elbow injury, if my back gets really bad, I might end up then being entitled to specially adapted housing for that condition.
Yes.
So help me. After the 2008 rating decision, we then have another filing, 2010-ish.
Yes, Your Honor.
How was that different than the one before?
Your Honor, my understanding is that it was not different. It continued to look at, or he continued to look for specially adapted housing benefits based on his low back disability. He submitted a claim in February 2007. A regional office in 2008 denied the claim, and then he files it again, another claim in 2010, and in a March 2012 rating decision, it again, it states that the regional office found that the claim remained denied.
So that's the problem I'm having with it. It's a procedural problem, right? So this is an odd thing. I'll tell you what my concern is. The June 2008 rating decision to me is either dispositive or it's irrelevant, and I can't figure out which one it is, right? Because normally it would be dispositive in this type of situation because you have an adverse determination that was final and for which the claimant never sought revision on cue during his lifetime.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it does seem to me that the thing that was filed in 2010 is the beginning of the claim stream that's before us today.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it didn't seem like that was treated as dispositive until we get to the board decision, which says, by the way, you never sought to revise.
Sure, Your Honor. And the March 2012 decision, I think saying that the claim remains denied is predicated on that June 2008 rating decision. And so, like Your Honor said, doesn't necessarily need to be new and material evidence that's added. The June 2008 decision is dispositive. He was deemed to be ineligible based on his low back disability, and that is still the disability in which he's attempting to get specially adapted housing benefits. And so just because he files a new claim, there's a new rating decision, that June 2008 decision where the veteran was deemed ineligible is still dispositive in this case. And, Your Honor, Judge Greenberg, you mentioned the availability of non-pro-tunc relief. It's the Secretary's position that although this court may have the authority to issue non-pro-tunc relief, issuance of that type of relief in this instance is inappropriate.
Why?
Your Honor, there are three prerequisites that must be met, and the proposed substitute here does not meet the first two prerequisites.
What are the three?
The three are that the case must be submitted to the court, that the proposed substitute has standing, and that considerations of equity and fairness or justice and fairness have been satisfied. And, Your Honor, the case was not submitted to the court. No briefing had occurred. The procedural posture of the case is very different than this court's or the federal circuit's in Padgett. And of course, this first prerequisite, the submission prerequisite, really goes to the purpose of non-pro-tunc relief, which is to make it so that the parties don't suffer as a result of any delay on behalf of the court. And as the parties have agreed, there is no delay on behalf of the court. Your Honor, in the September 2020 response, the proposed substitute stated that none of it, the delay, was the court's fault. So this first submission prerequisite is really central to the purpose of non-pro-tunc relief. And the failure to satisfy it is dispositive, but as you know, it's also the Secretary's position that the proposed substitute here does not have standing, again, for the same reasons that I mentioned, that there's no legal entitlement, there's no basis, no mechanism by which the proposed substitute here could recover the benefits sought.
I have another question on a different subject. What about the duty to assist, the statutory duty to assist? What did the VA do to instruct either Smith or Hicks what was necessary to perfect their case? What more were they supposed to submit? Let me put it this way. What, if anything, did the VA do to satisfy the statutory duty to assist the veteran in making their claim?
Your Honor, once VA learned that the veteran passed away, there were two letters sent to the estate here, the veteran, that basically said, you know, that identified the certain benefits that were available, asking the court to, or the proposed substitute to notify the court or notify VA of you know, any additional information that it needed to know. And I'll note throughout the history here of the procedure of this case, VA has pretty consistently sent things to the veteran and attempted to solicit the information needed. For example, before the March 2012 rating decision was issued, the VA sent to the veteran a letter basically saying, hey, here's what you need to substantiate the claim.
Well, what did the letter say? Is that letter in this file, in this record?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'd be happy to look and see if
Do you know what it said? If you can summarize it for me.
Sure. In the regional,
what did it say you had to do, Mr. Veteran, in order to perfect your appeal?
I'm not sure exactly what the letter said. In the March 2012 rating decision, it discusses that it told the veteran what he needed to do to substantiate his claim, and the veteran did not respond to that request.
I'd like to see that, along with this other document that we're getting from the appellant. Would you mind submitting both those letters? If there are two, and if there are more, please submit those.
Of course.
We'll consider the record supplemented with those. Just send it to the clerk.
Of course. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Any questions from...
If I could summarize your position, it basically is that the issue of substitution at the court is a means to an end, all right? In other words, the end is the receipt of some sort of benefit at the agency level. And it seems to me your position is that's the main question. Right. In other words, if there isn't a way for the Ms. Hicks to be entitled to some portion of benefits, if we found error in the decision, then the whole purpose of substitution at the court isn't satisfied because there needs to be this ability to obtain the benefit at the agency. Is that fair?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Judge Falvey.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions. Did Mrs. Hicks ever apply for an eligibility determination?
No, she did not, Your Honor.
Even still?
No, Your Honor.
What's the Secretary's position on, an implicit eligibility determination? Is that a possible...
Your Honor, no, that's not something that the Secretary would endorse. Again, the proposed substitute here would need to file a claim with VA, especially in the context of accrued benefits, which, of course, this is a non-accrued benefit. But in the context of an accrued benefit, the proposed substitute would have to file a claim within 1 year of the veteran's death. And I know this court in Reeves had a similar situation, but a different statutory framework with the informal claim process here since 2015. There's the intent to file a claim process where essentially within a year, the proposed substitute would need to file a claim on the specific form required by the secretary. And if the intent to, if there's if some information is missing, they can basically supplement the form within a year. But there is no implicit determination made by the secretary or that the secretary would endorse regarding a claim for benefits after the veteran's death.
And that, in part, goes to your standing argument as well, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
That one of the reasons she has no standing is there's really no mechanism to...
Yes, Your Honor.
To substitute her at this point.
Correct, Your Honor. Even if substitution occurred and this court found that there was error on behalf of the board, there's no legal mechanism in which she would be entitled to this benefit.
By that, you're not saying we need to get into the merits of whether or not Mr. Smith would have been eligible for this benefit.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, because even if this court were to determine that he was eligible and that the regional office and the board erred in some way, there's still no way that she could recover the benefit. And, of course, the secretary is not agreeing that there was error or anything or waiving that by any means. But best-case scenario, there's still no legal entitlement to the reimbursement of these funds.
By this movement?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Anything else?
No, Your Honor. Again, the Secretary respectfully requests that this court deny the motion to substitute and dismiss this appeal.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from the appellant's counsel for rebuttal. Before you begin, are you familiar with these two letters referred to by counsel for the government? You say you've been part of this case for 10 years ago.
Yes, I am. One of the points I would make is that they certainly did not put us on notice of anything that needed to be done to perfect Ms. Hicks' right to appeal. Nothing of that sort was in any of that correspondence.
Well, of course not. That's not what the VA said. The VA, he was alive. It was 2012. The question is,
We're talking about the notice in.
The notice in 2012 that you asked him to submit, I think, Judge Greenberg.
Well, I'm writing about these letters
in 2012, right?
Yes.
So the point was, those were just letters. I'm assuming you'll agree, Mr. Martin. We've probably seen them 100 of times. They're standard VCAA letters about what you need to do in a particular case in terms of submitting evidence. So my bet is that when we get the letters from the Secretary, they're going to say you have to submit evidence of your eligibility under the program. Maybe there's an income level. I mean, whatever the requirements are. But of course, they didn't go anything to Ms. Hicks, right?
We received statements of the case from the regional office in February of 2014 and later in 2015, I believe it was. If I can find the date. But the one from 2014 says the claim for entitlement to a special home adaptation and or special adaptive housing grant claimed as purchase and installation of home spa is considered reopened but remains denied. So we've got two statements in the record. If you look at the record, page 316 and page 600, there are letters from the VA saying basically looking back, words to 2008 and to this point in time, 2014, that they considered this claim to be one they were they're still evaluating, they're reopening, but they were denied. And the reason they were denied was for reasons that we could not satisfy because they read the law incorrectly, we believe. They read the law.
Could you just help me, though, understand? I understand your argument, but I have no, and maybe it's me, I literally have no idea what that has to do with the question about whether your client can be substituted to get a benefit. There are situations in the world that we just can't remedy. This might not be one of them, right? But there are going to be situations in which a claimant dies. They have an excellent appeal. They should have won. They lost because the agency made a mistake. But then they die, and there's nobody to substitute for them, let's say, right? And so the fact of agency error, I just do not understand what that has to do with substitution.
Well, I was addressing the issue of the finality of the 2008 decision and making the point that was reopened. You're raising, I believe, a different question. And the arguments we've made in our last filing with the court were that there's three grounds for doing so. One, it has to do with the 43 standard in light of the statute regulations for the SAH program. The second argument has to do with the non-proton standard. And the third argument has to do with whether you can interpret the regulations under 38 U.S.C. 5115 in a way that benefits the veteran. We think those are three alternative grounds. The one thing I would point out as to the non-proton argument is that we disagree with the VA's analysis of the law. They contend that the first requirement, which involves a case being submitted, that was involved under the Pecular I can't recall the other case.
Breedlove.
Well, Breedlove changed that.
Right.
Breedlove changed all that. And that's why that argument's no good anymore. Because they basically said, look, Congress passed 38 U.S.C. 5115 so that there wouldn't be this zone of non-substitution. They wanted to liberalize the standards for substitution. So if that's the point of that statute, then finding that you had to finally submit a case is gone. That is not, for non-protunct relief, that cannot be any longer a legitimate element. And you still should look
at it. Isn't that, though, isn't the point was that in the cases before there was the change in, 5121A at the agency, the court had a requirement for issuing orders nunc-pro-tunc. And then, as I read Breedlove in the first paragraph or two of the decision, the court says, well, now that we know that that's changed at the agency, that now that there's substitution, the only interest in play isn't that somebody's hurt by a delay by the court, right? And so there's no need to have a substitution a submission requirement, because we now have Congress acting to provide for a substitution at the agency.
Correct.
But that's not true here, right? Is it with non-accrued benefits, right?
Well, it is true if you apply the non-protunct standard by reasoning that this statutory language doesn't expressly address the one-time reimbursement situation. And if that regulation doesn't address it, and that statute doesn't expressly address it, then you still have non-protunct authority. And that authority does not require the case to be submitted. It simply requires that there be a statutory regulatory basis for the claim, and it requires that the equities and justice are satisfied in order to allow the substitution. So we submit that the court should take a look at the non-protunct standard if it believes that it can't award relief under a more liberal reading of 38 U.S.C. 515 or 515A. We did in our brief argue why you can read that statute to authorize that type of relief. And for purposes of substitution, apart from the merits of the claim, we think that that's an appropriate way to go. I think I would like to emphasize some of the equities here that really need to be considered if you're looking at non-protunct relief or if you're looking generally at the substitution standard. Number one, you have a situation where the veteran on his own, because he didn't expect a preauthorization or there wasn't a preauthorization requirement for getting funding, built his spa to meet the treatment requirements his VA doctors told him he needed to. He saved the VA significant money by doing that. From 2007 to his death in 2019, the VA saved far more than what he spent on that. You now have a situation where the substitute appellant has been on her own paying those same expenses. She's not being reimbursed. You have another situation in which the law has changed in his favor, but the VA refuses to acknowledge that. You don't have a preauthorization requirement that was applicable at the time he applied for it. The VA was wrong about that. And you don't have a complete disability inability to walk standard. The Jensen decision makes that clear. And other opinions from the Board of Veterans' Appeal make that clear. So Mr. Smith, when he had this appeal before the board, walked in with a cane. The judge saw him there. It's apparent that he met the standard. And yet, he still was denied the benefits that he felt he was entitled to receive. So if you're looking at the equities, as you should if you're going to consider non-protunct as a basis for relief here, those are things that are very important. And for the VA to say right now that Ms. Hicks should have gone through some process in which she refiled the claim with the VA in the face of two board decisions that denied the claim and four other regional office decisions that denied the claim, and that's what she had to do to determine her eligibility, that's a pretty rich approach for treatment of a veteran who's entitled to receive the benefit of the doubt under their statutes. That is not the way this program was supposed to be admitted. I don't think that's a fair way for the VA to be interpreting their regulations. Don't make her go back and refile a claim when you know full well that they're going to deny it because the merit decisions that they're going to use as precedent would require that. The only place where we could get relief was before this court, appealing the board decisions. This is it. And she has standing to be here. She's been injured in fact. Her father was judged by standards that are no longer applicable. And all we're asking is for a chance to get to the merits of those decisions. And maybe we won't need to get that far if we get a decision that standing's appropriate. Because it should be obvious at that point that what the VA's done is treat a veteran unfairly.
Thank you. Any questions?
I do. You a couple times you said the VA shouldn't force her to go back and file a claim or anything, but I think what they're talking about is a eligibility determination. Isn't that different than a claim?
Not the way the VA has treated this, Mr. Smith and his daughter.
So within
they conflated the two. She was not going to be able to get standing because they, I thought you just heard that they determined she wasn't eligible.
Well, I don't know that that's what they argued, but I understood them to say, and I think it was in response to questions I asked, that she has no standing because there's no mechanism, because she didn't submit a eligibility determination within the 1 year period, and there's no way of going back and doing that, so she has no standing. That's at least one of their responses to your standing argument, I think.
Well, standing,
they didn't. I didn't hear them to say she needs to go. She needs to go back and file another claim.
Well, that gets into the question that I think Judge Greenberg got into. Isn't there in that if that's the position, isn't there some obligation on their part to help the veteran then to say, look, you know, we rejected your claim for all other reasons in the past, but now you're just looking at standing, so come tell us your basis for standing. I mean, that was a futile exercise to expect her and me to go back to the VA and get an answer we knew would be unfavorable when the only course of relief was before this court. We don't think is the appropriate way for evaluating their regulations.
But your relief at this court is premised on her ability to substitute. So you think you'd want to go through the steps necessary to try to substitute yourself?
Well, we believe she can be substituted for three reasons, as I mentioned.
Well, but there has to be a determination within 1 year, or a submission for a determination.
If those are under regulations 38 U.S.C. 5115, 5115A, that don't talk about one-time reimbursements. They don't really fit her case. We know that.
Well, but the only regulation you pointed to also contains a one-year period. Right. The only regulation that deals with non-accrued, I don't like the word non-accrued benefits, the one-time payment, it also includes a one-year time period to submit a form.
The form would do what? Tell the VA about the expenses?
No.
They already have
it. It would say, I'm proposing that I'm a person eligible to be substituted. Could you determine if I
We submitted a form the same day we asked her to be substituted to the VA. We said she is the party. What more did we need to do? We weren't going to reopen the process and say, now take another look at your two board decisions and five other regional office decisions and see if we can get relief now. We did. We told them in a form, the form they said we should submit, that Ms. Hicks was the one.
So you did submit?
Yes.
Now I'm confused.
I am too.
Okay.
We'll submit that form to the...
That's in the record, but we'll submit
What form are you talking about? Is it the form to be recognized as an accrued benefit substitute?
Excuse me, Your Honor. I think I have a copy of it.
If you
I have a copy, but I can provide it.
So, and yes, that would be, well, let me tell you, that could be dispositive for me. But is it your position now that you did submit a form to VA on Ms. Hicks' behalf that sought to be recognized at the agency level as an accrued benefits recipient?
Don't recall the nature of the form, whether it was accrued benefits recipient, but it was to advise them that she was the party continuing with his claim, yes.
Well, but you see, what you just said is not the way the system works. It's not that somebody walks into the VA and says, I'm the person, thank you very much, right? The idea is that the form is not the form that asks for reimbursement here. It's the form that gives VA the information necessary for them to say you are or are not an accrued benefits claimant, which then would allow the appeal process to work for that issue. But I with the presiding judge's okay, I would definitely like you to submit that form to the court, because it could make all the difference in the world if, in fact, you did.
Well, we did submit the form. You will have it in short order. Our position is, regardless of what the form says or what it's supposed to do, this court still has the authority to grant standing under those three arguments we've advanced. That particular form is not dispositive, because all it would have done was trigger another process before the VA, which had already determined she wasn't eligible or her father wasn't eligible for benefits.
All right.
So couldn't have resulted in any relief.
Anything else?
Anything else? No.
Have you made all the points you want to make?
Yes, I have.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank counsel for an excellent argument and your excellent written submissions. We understand the case. Prior custom has been for the court to come down and greet counsel in person, but under the peculiar circumstances of the day, I think we'll just say a job well done by all counsel, and thank you very much, and the case will be submitted.
Thank you.
All right. I think we'll just go out.
Where's the recess?